first part should be known in this contract as the party of the first part.
The witness will comply under the, this I got a C rule.
Judge Hurd is stumped by this case. I've also misplaced my judge hammer.
The justice system works swiftly in the future now that they've abolished all lawyers.
My client will suggest that your client drives my client back to your client's flat, where your client will play some James Taylor.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 519. I'm Thomas, not a lawyer. That's Andrew, lawyer. How you doing, Lawyer Andrew?
I, as good as any lawyer can do, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. So, you know, maybe someone just tuned into our show for the first time, just wanted to clarify. Like, you know, I mean, it's pretty obvious the minute I start talking, but you never know. I don't want someone to think I'm the lawyer.
I wouldn't want anyone to think that yet.
Ooh. But we have a bevy of lawyers on today's show. Not only do we have Andrew Torres, we've got Ace Associate Morgan Stringer coming on for Brittany Part 2. Can't wait to hear the update on that. I hope it's a little bit better news. We'll see. The reporting has been interesting. We'll see how that all shakes up.
Yeah, the reporting is that's done, right? That's, you know.
We'll have to see what Morgan says. She's the expert. Let's go ahead and bring Morgan on for Pop Law, Brittany Part 2.
Of course, the Bob Blah Blah Law Blog.
And we are joined once again by Ace Associate Morgan Stringer, because there is a Britney update, and I'm sure our listeners will recall our first Britney episode. How are you doing, Ace Associate Morgan Stringer?
I'm doing well, and thank y'all for having me back. A lot of legal news in pop culture, but I thought the listeners would really like an update on beloved icon Britney Spears and her conservatorship battle, otherwise, as we know, the hashtag Free Britney campaign.
Yeah.
So let's, I guess, talk about what happened since we last spoke. So she testified in court a few months ago, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. She was forced to get an IUD. She said that the conservatorship made her feel trapped. It was really awful what, you know, happened to her. And bottom line of that testimony, though, is that she wants the conservatorship to end. So I know I asked last time the question why she did not petition for that. And it turns out Britney said she did not know that she could petition to end the conservatorship at any time.
Oh, wow. What? Yeah.
How is that the explanation for all that? Wow. Okay. But what about her lawyer? I mean, is this, shouldn't somebody have known this?
Yes, that's what, and I'm not sure how that happened, because her lawyer also seems stunned. So her lawyer, that was Samuel Ingram III, he was court appointed. He withdrew after that testimony, and so did actually Bessemer Trust.
Yeah, what was the relationship with Bessemer Trust there?
So Bessemer Trust was supposed to become a co-conservator of the finance aspect of a conservatorship, but after that testimony, they wanted out completely, and they actually had not formally taken over the assets yet at that point. So they, you know, it was an easy transition to just get them out of it, the picture completely.
Yeah, I can't imagine why they would want out after that kind of. So, does Britney have a lawyer now, or what's the status?
Yes. So, Matthew Rosengart, he is one of these rock star attorneys. He's an entertainment lawyer and a former federal prosecutor. His clients actually include Steven Spielberg, Keanu Reeves, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and others. He also has been named one of Hollywood Reporter's power lawyers repeatedly, including this year. So apparently the Hollywood Reporter power lawyers is a thing you can be on. Yeah. So there's a list
Andrew,
for us to get on.
You haven't gotten that? Not on that list?
Yeah, I could use, you know, some new editorial glamour shots, right?
Let's get you a publicist.
Morgan, yeah. Morgan, I think, has a great chance of getting
it.
Ooh,
yeah. So,
All right. So you've got Rosengart. What has the new lawyer done on the case?
Yes. On July 26th, he petitioned the court to remove Jamie Spears, Brittany's dad, as a conservator and instead have an interim fiduciary, Jason Rubin, from Certified Strategies act as a conservator. Because remember, Jamie remains the sole conservator now since Bessemer dropped out, which it was a good thing Bessemer dropped out. But again, that leaves, you know, the person that Brittany wants the least involved with her conservatorship. So again, I'm going to note that Brittany can petition to end the conservatorship at any time. And her lawyer actually has indicated that he will. But I think they're trying this path of least resistance strategy where if they get rid of Jamie Spears, then it's going to be a lot less of an uphill battle.
I have a couple of questions. First is, what information is really getting out to us, right? Because last time we talked about this, you know, you mentioned that like virtually all the records are sealed. So, you know, did we learn anything from the new petition or, you know, where are you getting your information from?
Yeah, there was actually some really good articles that did come out about this, but there was a lot of bad articles that came out about this. So I'm going to get to that. So we did actually learn some information this time. Like, as you said, you know, some of those records have been sealed. So last time I pointed out that we know Jamie gets paid $16,000 a month for being conservator, which, you know, the documentary made a big deal about. But I pointed out that's not a ton of money. Thomas lives in California, can tell you in the grand scheme of things.
I was going to say, not a ton relative to how much she's probably pulling in as well.
Exactly. But hold on to your seats now. That is $2,000 a month more than what Brittany actually gets from her own estate.
So it's like he gets paid more to kind of be in charge of her than she gets paid out from her estate, which she is the person, the only reason there is that money. Is that, do I have that right?
That is exactly right. And it gets so much worse.
Oh, wow.
So Jamie also gets an extra $2,000 per month on top of that for, quote, office expenses. I don't know what that means. So I guess just to, you know, I don't know because he's already being paid $16,000 a month. I don't know what, if he needs like an uptown LA office or what. But he also got 1.5% of the gross revenues and merch earnings from Britney's Vegas tour. That came out to $2.1 million.
Wow.
And 2.95% commission on her Femme Fatale tour. That was $500,000.
Okay. And trying to parse out the arguments, right? I know that part of the argument for the increased fees for the father's attorney, who was a co-conservator, was that the attorney was getting cuts because the conservatorship was able to make money and get into these deals that otherwise Brittany wouldn't be able to get into on her own. So, you know, was there any kind of evidence that Jamie Spears was helping with those deals? I mean, I'm trying to steel bot, you know, getting paid those kind of large lump sums up front.
Absolutely not. He was not part of those deals. As you'll recall, another thing that's a big red flag of him being a conservator in the first place is that he has no financial experience. He's just some dude from, you know, he's just from Kentwood, Louisiana, you know, just hanging out. And according to the petition, yeah, he had nothing to do with these deals. He is not her agent. He is not, you know, wheeling and dealing out there, or at least not on her behalf. Now, I don't know what he's doing on his own, but yeah, no, he's not her agent and has not been a part of her obtaining those deals whatsoever.
Is the logic of it that, just as you say, from the other side, or at least the logic of the way it's set up, is the logic of it that she could not manage on her own, so therefore the person who is in charge of helping her even manage is entitled to some cut of this stuff because without this person, she wouldn't even be able to do any of this. Is that the logic of it?
Yeah, no, that doesn't make any sense either because actually if a parent is a conservator of a conservatorship, it usually is not practice that they get paid to manage it at all.
Ooh,
now,
okay.
The justification could be this is a large estate, but again, he's getting compensated for that. He should not be getting compensated for these extra, you know, these extra percentages and cuts on revenue and things of that nature. He should not be getting that at all, in my opinion.
So any way you work it out, it's, you know, someone trying to make more money, just pure and simple.
Yes. And it's all terrible. And But I noticed last week there were these headlines that said Britney was almost free, basically, because Jamie petitioned last week to step down from the conservatorship. And right. So there were all these headlines saying, oh, she's there, you know, hashtag free Britney, yay, pop the champagne, let's have a parade and hang the banners. But it's more like hang the mission accomplished banner. reference for listeners, because Jamie actually did not petition to step down from a conservatorship. It's the opposite of what a lot of people reported. Yes. So if you recall, I mentioned that Britney's attorney filed to remove him from that conservatorship. What Jamie filed was actually an objection to that, but he did this in a very sneaky way. So Jamie's lawyer, who is Vivian Thorine, she says in the petition, there are no actual grounds for suspending or removing him from the conservatorship, and that it is highly debatable whether a change in a conservator at this time would be in Ms. Spears' best interests. Nevertheless, even as Mr. Spears is the unremitting target of unjustified attacks, he does not believe that a public battle with his daughter over his continuing service as her conservator would be in her best interests.
Mm, poor guy.
Yeah, poor him.
We've been too hard on this guy making 20 zillions of dollars for doing nothing. You're right. Who's the real victim here?
Yeah, and they're telling the court, you know, it's not in her best interest to have Jamie removed, but they are also trying to make it look like that it is also in her best interest to have him removed, but that's only because of a public attention. So they're trying to have it both ways here by saying that, you know, this is not in her best interest as a conservatee. And remember that what is in the conservatee's actual best interest is the standard. So this is a really sneaky way of saying it actually is not in Britney's best interest to remove Jamie. I'm only saying I'm going to step aside because I love my daughter so much. And he actually says that he should stay on to finish up the 12th account. And that is the 2019 financials. But then he says, I need to stay on until all the financials are done up to the date that he steps down.
So the reason everybody reported this badly was because he threw in some, like, you know, essentially dicta about, like, oh, yeah, step aside. But really, he wasn't actually even stepping aside. How did everybody get this exactly backwards?
So I think that they did because of that language, right? And I think he put that in to have this sort of PR spin on it.
He listens to OA. Like, he's like, I know how badly the law is reported in the media.
Exactly. Which is why I'm doing this segment, because there seems to be this real gap of, you know, there's pop culture reporters and then there's legal reporters. And then there's some that do a good job of in between. You know, the LA Times actually did a great article about this, and you know, they also noticed, as I did, that it's not as simple as it seems. Ooh. So,
he didn't count on ace associate Morgan Stringer on OA, everybody. We got him.
You can't get past me. You can try.
So I want to go back to what you said before that, which is apparently as conservator, right? Again, making $16,000 a month plus an extra $2,000 for his office expenses, which admittedly doesn't go that far.
That's all nothing compared to the percentages of the shows, too, where he's getting millions of dollars.
Yeah, but presumably he gets those regardless, right? Or is that that's also tied to the conservatorship?
Yeah, that was part of my understanding of it, is that because, you know, obviously they have not let me see those contracts, but but my understanding is that was part of the deal with the Vegas residency, is that he would get these percentages, and the excuse is, you know, that I'm managing the conservatorship.
Got it. So he was in a position to negotiate that deal because of his role as conservator.
But he did not actually do the negotiation of it. But he did enough to, like, I guess, get the cut. But he was not the one, like, calling up these different casinos, you know, saying, hey, I can get Britney there and everything. Yeah, no, he was not involved in any actual, like, work to get this done.
Got it.
Well, I have to imagine that it's essentially the kind of thing where it's like he has the power. He would probably have veto power, right? Because he's in charge of her. So it's almost like paying a cut to a mobster or something, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I do think that, because as you'll recall, I noted that the conservatorship is not just her finances, it's her personhood.
Yeah.
So, but I don't want to lose track of this. He's only accounted for the finances up to 2019?
Yes. So, and there is a reason for that. So these accountings take years. They can, even in a regular conservatorship. So, oh, okay. Because they're just not a very big priority of the courts, as you can imagine, you know, judicial resources, you know, we need to fund our courts better. That's a different rant for a different time. But yeah, the 2019 financials also were not filed until August of 2020, and they still are not finalized. And this is the 12th account that I was referring to earlier. And obviously we're in 2021 now. So Jamie is very sneaky about this, or his attorney is rather, by saying, not only until he is up to date completely will he then resign. So, well, gee, sure, it's a shame that that date just won't come, because it's so hard for him to stay up on those darn financial statements, you know? So he's saying basically, oh, not only to the 12th account, but then, oh no, well, I just got to the 2020 account, so now, you know, I'm still behind. I'm always going to be constantly behind, and this magical date just is never going to come.
So, essentially, he can stay on as conservator indefinitely, right? Like, it's sort of, you know, Achilles and the tortoise, right? Like, the financials will always take up so much time that you'll never catch up to them. And by the time you do, there's a fresh new batch of financials that have come in. Am I understanding that properly?
You are exactly right. That is exactly the plan here. That's why I said it is kind of a one weird trick by saying, you know, oh, I love my daughter so much, I'm going to step aside. But, oh no, this magical date hasn't come. What are you going to do? Oh, shucks.
And I mean, my understanding from a legal perspective that as a conservator, like even after you have petitioned to withdraw, there's still a period in which you have to answer to the court for the areas over which you were responsible during the period of your conservatorship, right?
That is correct. So Jamie can actually petition to resign at any time. The end. You're no longer conservator, but he still would have to turn in those financial reports and tie up other loose ends. And he can actually tie up all those loose ends without having to be the named conservator. So basically the court would say, okay, you're out of here, go home. But while you're at home, finish up what you were doing and basically find a good stopping place. And he would still have to answer to the court for the work that he did and for the finances while he was the conservator. The court maintains jurisdiction over him, but we have a new conservator now that has come in. Just basically find a good stopping place.
And he'd be able to run expenses through, I mean, not at the same level, but you know, wind up expenses. He'd still be able to petition the court for the estate to pay those, right?
Yeah, so he wouldn't be paid for that because he would not be acting as a conservator and he would be having to do that anyway. But I'm sure if he ran into out-of-pocket expenses or something of that nature, then yeah. Yes, he yeah, could petition for that.
Well, and, you know, this $2,000 a month office and, you know, it seems like he's got other expenses that he's been running through this gravy train for a while.
Yeah, it seems quite a bit, as we see, apparently millions of dollars, which is something I mentioned last time I was on, you know, that I don't know what the motive is, because again, as you know, Thomas can attest to, California is very expensive, you know, about $100,000 a year isn't, you know, I'm making it out here in LA. So yeah, that is what's happening. But yeah, no, if a conservator was not allowed to basically tie up loose ends while not after they petitioned to end the their conservatorship status, then transferring conservatorships would be an absolute nightmare because then you would be stuck over the conservatorship forever.
Sure, sure. That makes sense.
As we're running out of time, we skipped right over the IUD thing. Did you have thoughts on that? Like, what was that? What was happening?
Oh, God. I mean, anger.
Yeah.
That was the thought, just pure rage. So, yeah, she, because again, Jamie Spears is the conservator over her personhood. So he arranges all of her medical care. He arranges all of her doctor's appointments. And she was told to get an IUD. She was forced to get one. And she mentioned that she, you know, she has a boyfriend now and she wanted to have another child. And she couldn't because she was being forced to get an IUD against her will.
Is that really how this works? I was just hoping this was more bad reporting. So in a... Okay. Maybe topic for another show. But in a conservatorship, you're saying that, like, he is able to make medical decisions. So she's in a doctor's appointment and what? He's there, like, saying you have to get this? And the doctor's like, well, he's the conservator. Like, I don't know how this would even work. I guess my mind is blown here.
Yes, he is her agent for all purposes of that. She basically is, it's like she's incompetent to make medical decisions for herself. So he makes the medical decisions for her, even if she objects to them.
What kind of doctor would do that, though? Like, I would, you know, like, wouldn't you just be like, I'm not going to do something against a person's will who I obviously can talk to right here in front of me? That's crazy.
Yeah, Los Angeles is full of all kinds of dark characters. That was something that I thought about as well. You know, what kind of doctor would clearly see that this person did not want this to be happening and do it against somebody's will? It's unconscionable. But, you know, there's people out there that are willing to do it.
Well, what's next? What are we looking for as the next development?
So there actually is going to be another hearing. It'll be on September 29th. Brittany's lawyer did file a petition to expedite a hearing on the issue of removing Jamie, and that was actually denied. September 29th is the date. They are not going to be moving it up. And it's expected that the judge is going to address Jamie's objection and Brittany's removal petition, but there's some other smaller filings that the judge needs to address as well. So we're going to see what happens with that. She may address it, she may not. We'll just see what happens September 29th.
All right. Well, we'll have to check back in with you after that. I cannot believe how wrong everybody has gotten this story. So I'm looking forward to you covering the next developments.
For sure. And also, there's a lot of legal issues in pop culture to delve into. There's another conservatorship battle actually happening involving Nichelle Nichols. She was on Star Trek. So listeners may be familiar with her. She is having a conservatorship battle happening right now. Also, Scarlett Johansson, obviously. She sued Disney. So, there's legal issues always in Hollywood, and they just, a lot of times, do not get reported on or talked about well. But another time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ace Associate Morgan Stringer, for the Pop Law. Bob Blah Blah's Pop Law segment. There's always Pop Law on the banana stand. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Morgan.
Thanks for having me on again. Until next time, y'all.
Hey, everybody. This is an ad for Moinkbox. I have told you 100,000 times that their bacon is literally the best bacon I've ever had. So instead, I am going to tell you about the other products that I have gotten from Moinkbox and I have made recently. They sent salmon fillets. It was unbelievably delicious. So they're not advertising this as sashimi-grade salmon. I will tell you, I did not cook their salmon. Don't take cooking salmon advice from a podcast. It was unbelievably delicious. So, you know, Moinkbox, you sign up. They deliver grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, wild-caught Alaskan salmon that I just told you about, all direct to your door, helping family farms become financially independent outside of Big Ag. They're animals raised outdoors. Their fish swim wild in the ocean. Their Moink meat is free of antibiotics. Look, it is really good meat. And you know this because I love to cook, I love to eat, and Moink stuff is fantastic. So what I want you to do is sign up moinkbox.com/OA. And you know the promo. You sign up, you get a year of bacon for free, and then you get to pick the meats that you want delivered with that box, right? So you can change what you want each month. You can, you know, branch out, try new stuff. You can cancel anytime. I'm going to read, once again, even though I don't have to, their ad copy, which is, they'll guarantee you'll say, oink, oink, I'm just so happy I got moinked. And if I'm willing to say that, you should be willing to try out their food. So join the Moink movement today. Go to moinkbox.com/OA right now. You get free bacon for a year. 1 year of the best bacon you will ever taste for a limited time. moinkbox.com/OA. moinkbox.com/OA. Give them a try. These guys are great sponsors. I love their stuff, and you will too.
This episode is brought to you by Cuts Clothing. Folks, this is so funny because I'm supposed to tell you about Cuts' 5th year anniversary. And last time I told you, I had an anniversary once back in the, it was my 10th podcasting anniversary last year. I did not realize until one Teresa Gomez reminded me that it's actually the 5th anniversary of Opening Arguments, this very episode. Isn't that crazy? So yeah, we're celebrating 5 years, and so is Cuts. 5 years ago, Cuts founder Steve Borelli set out to create clothes for every occasion the modern man faces. Since then, Cuts has become the Tesla of t-shirts, hoodies, polos, sweatshirts, and more. I love Cuts because, I've said this before, I golf a lot, and the Cuts polo is perfect. A lot of those old dad golf shirts, they're hideous. They were terrible. Not with Cuts clothing. The Cuts polo shirt is great for golf, but it's also great for just hanging around. It's perfect. You can use them for both. Their polo is a design that keeps you fitted for the office, the golf course, or even your next date. So, this month, as I said, marks the Cuts' 5th anniversary, and they're doing it big with 2 collection drops, a product launch, and a week-long special event. Join the celebration and get 15% off site-wide by going to cutsclothing.com/opening. That's cutsclothing.com/opening for 15% off and access to anniversary events all month long. That's way better than you're getting for Opening Arguments' 5th anniversary. You're just getting this episode. But I mean, it's almost as good. But anyway, Cuts Clothing.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no. I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
All right, Andrew. Enough time here for more law for everybody. What's the good... wait, hold on. I'm seeing in the spreadsheet, good news. That's a rare... If I do a control F for good news in our spreadsheet in the lifetime of the show, there's
you
like...
You will not get a lot
of
it.
Yeah, like 7. So what's the good news?
Yeah, well, there's... I'm going to combine... This is going to be a good news, bad news segment.
I knew it. Can't just be
look,
good news.
Look, no. There's an unequivocal good news opinion, okay? That opinion is an intermediate Illinois appellate court in a case called Hobby Lobby versus Somerville. So that tells you Hobby Lobby lost. Those are not hard to figure out. And that has to do with trans rights under the Illinois Human Rights Act. I want to contrast that with an opinion issued the same day, en banc 5th Circuit, interpreting Texas SB 8 that is being... grossly misdescribed as like the butchering babies inside the womb bill.
Oh, God.
I shouldn't have been facetious there. The bill refers to the D&E procedure, dilation and extraction, the most common second trimester abortion procedure as, quote, dismemberment abortion. And I want to hit that opinion because the contrast between these two fits into a thesis statement I've been advocating for a while now, that until we can, you know, manage to un-F the courts, you know, however we do that, the idea that you should be looking to not just activism at the state level, but even where state causes of action, state statutes, state constitutional provisions are exactly the same as their federal counterparts, that you should be arguing in state courts on those state statutes where you have a chance of winning. So let's start with the Illinois case. This is a really, really good way to illustrate that. So this case is Hobby Lobby versus Somerville, and it involves a longstanding employee of Hobby Lobby, a trans woman by the name of Megan Somerville. This is exactly the kind of behavior you might imagine. Ms. Somerville began transitioning in 2007, did not disclose her female gender identity to anyone at Hobby Lobby until 2009. And that's when she began receiving medical treatment that resulted in female secondary sex characteristics, such as enlarged breasts, the absence of facial hair, etc. So 2010 is when she began to use that name, Megan Somerville, and appear at work in what the court describes as feminine dress and makeup without objection from Hobby Lobby. In July 2010, she obtained a court order legally changing her name to Megan Renee Somerville, got a new driver's license, a new social security card, both of which showed her new name and identified her as female. So, right, everything seems to be coming up roses. But this is Hobby Lobby, so that couldn't last.
Oh, and it's 2010. That's like an eternity ago in trans rights years.
It really is. So, on July 9th, 2010, Somerville formally informed Hobby Lobby of her transition and her intent to begin, say it with me, using the women's bathroom at the store. So Hobby Lobby changed her personnel records, benefits information, updated her as a woman, but refused to allow her to use the bathroom. Faced with an initial demand that she produce, quote, legal authority requiring it to allow her to use the bathroom, Somerville provided Hobby Lobby with a variety of documentation, including her driver's license, her social security card, her name change, her court order, letter from her medical providers identifying her as female, describing the transition process. I mean, the kinds of things nobody should have to show their employer.
I was going
to
say, if someone asked me, like, can you legally justify the using the bathroom? I'd be like, do you want a urine sample? I mean, I need to go to the bathroom, and this is the bathroom. That's all. Yep. End of discussion. What are we doing here?
As it turns out, Hobby Lobby is not just, the court describes it as they, quote, assertively enforced its policy and mentions that Somerville occasionally used the women's restroom, even after being instructed not to, for a reason that I'm about to explain. So on February 23rd of 2011, she was given a written warning for entering the women's restroom at the store. She testified that she was emotionally devastated by receiving that written write-up, which I can imagine, and broke down crying. February 2013, she filed complaints with the Illinois Commission on Human Rights, alleging that she had been discriminated against on the basis of her gender identity in violation of the Illinois Human Rights Act, Articles 2 and 5, which cover employment and public accommodations. Throughout the course of the litigation, Hobby Lobby changed its position as to what it was requiring for her to use the women's restroom. So at one point, it said that she must undergo surgery. Well, she did that. Then it required she produce a birth certificate reflecting her sex as female, which she did. In December of 2013, Hobby Lobby installed a unisex bathroom at the store. Store employees and customers were permitted to use either the bathroom, quote, corresponding to their sex, or the unisex bathroom. But Hobby Lobby did not permit Ms. Somerville to use the store's women's bathroom. She was allowed to use the unisex bathroom. We're going to talk about that in a second. She also testified that the availability of the unisex bathroom did not ameliorate her feeling singled out for different treatment because she was trans, right?
I bet.
She, quote, felt like in some ways they were recognizing me as female, but yet they were segregating me. I felt as though there were the guys, the gals, and then me, end of quote, which I find incredibly easy to believe.
Yeah.
So we talk about why did she continue to use the women's bathroom? Well, it turned out that based on where she worked, the women's bathroom was close nearby and everything else was a 10-minute walk. And she later had some medical difficulty with it.
Forget everything else. That sounds kind of like a weird problem. Where did the just cis men go to the bathroom then? You know, they had to walk.
Here's how she put it. This is paragraph 11 of the complaint. As a result of Hobby Lobby's ban on her using the women's bathroom at work, Somerville was driven to try various ways of coping with her need to use the bathroom. For a couple of years, she was able to hold it and refrain from using the bathroom until her lunch break. But in 2012, she was diagnosed with a medical condition that led to her needing to use the bathroom 3 or 4 times a day. She began limiting
That's
her
called
fluid intake.
That's being a human. Did somebody Sorry. Are you guys not drinking enough water? Everybody drink more water. There's one thing I do well in life. It's actually drink enough water. It's like one of the few things I do. You should be going to the 3 to 4 times a day. That's just normal.
Yeah, what? I agree. I agree with
that. Hi, I have a medical condition. Here's my doctor's note. It says, this person is a human being. It's a condition I have.
Yeah. And remember, during this time, I mean, you asked the question about cis men. Hobby Lobby didn't install the unisex bathroom until 2013. So there was no other option at this point. There was, she could use the men's room or nothing, which she tried to do, or walk out to another store So the court then notes, if she left the store to use the bathroom at nearby businesses, she had to punch out from her work shift, walk about 10 minutes each way, a walk that occurred in fair or foul weather.
Gotcha.
So I'm not going to go further into all of the ways in which this was terrible, because it's obvious all the ways in which this is terrible. I'm going to go into the fact that this, like the Fourth Circuit's ruling in the Gavin Grimm case, is an unconditional victory, and that what makes it interesting, right, this is the Illinois State Intermediate Appellate Court. And it says, look, our state anti-discrimination statute sets out its goals, which is to secure for all individuals within Illinois the freedom from discrimination against any individual because of his or her sex or sexual orientation. And then it says, there is no dispute that, in this case, Hobby Lobby is barring Somerville from using the women's bathroom because she's a trans woman. That is, a woman whose designated sex at birth, and again, I'm quoting from the opinion here, was male instead of a woman who was designated as a female at birth. Hobby Lobby's conduct thus falls squarely within the definition of unlawful discrimination under the Act, as it treats Somerville differently from other women who work or shop at its store solely on the basis that their gender identity is not, quote, traditionally associated with her designated sex at birth. Commission found in her favor, trial court found in her favor. This is affirming that award of $220,000 in damages. So that is nice. Compensatory damages and damages for 4 years worth of intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Is that the end of it? Or can we get some, like, you know, penalty, whatever, to like, don't do this to other people?
That is the end of it with respect to Hobby Lobby. So okay. Yeah.
Sounds like not enough money, but at least
it sounds like not enough money to me too. Hobby Lobby is almost certainly going to appeal to the Illinois State Supreme Court, and I don't think they will take this case.
But I mean, I'm going to say that's not enough money. Hobby Lobby would gladly pay $200,000 to be mean to a trans person. Like they don't, you know, like that's not enough money.
We need a McDonald's
coffee lawsuit amount of money.
Yeah, that'll be great. And then, you know, people can completely misunderstand that one for the rest of their lives.
More show topics for us.
Fair enough. What I really, really like is a couple of things here, right? So the first is, as I alluded to at the beginning of the segment, Illinois' law does not differ greatly from Title VII. It is a standard anti-discrimination law. But more and more we are finding, as Trump has kind of put a capper on the politicization of the federal courts, state courts saying, we will not read our state statutes in pari materia, right? That is, as if they were equal to their federal counterparts, even if they use similar or the exact same language. And I want to tell you that this is a modern development. And by modern, I mean last 10 years, right? I mean, in response to George W. Bush's judicial appointees and Donald Trump's judicial appointees, right? Looking at Justin's and Corey's on the court with no background, no history, just imposing right-wing political outcomes on cases. And I can tell you that because of an area in which I have done and continue to do a fair amount of work, and that is fair employment practices cases, right? Virtually every state has a state fair employment statute, a wage and hour law that requires you to pay overtime. Those state statutes are virtual replicas, right, of the federal, the corresponding federal acts, right? And again, virtually every jurisdiction says we read our state's requirements in pari materia with the corresponding federal cases. So what that means is that when a federal court says, oh, you don't get overtime in X case if you're Y profession, while that wouldn't necessarily be binding on a state statute, when you say as a court, we're reading federal interpretations into it, now all of a sudden that becomes, again, it's still technically a persuasive opinion. It's still technically dicta, but it's basically a holding that applies in your state, right? So when federal courts decide things, even very, very conservative federal courts, they get read into how states interpret their own statutes. And this is a good example of how a state is moving away from that and is specifically analyzing, right, in language that applies only to the Illinois statute.
And that's how, a good thing to try to keep it out of the Justins and Corey's hands, you're saying?
Yep, that's okay, exactly good. Right.
Yep. Gotcha. Yep. Well, that's double good news so far. What was the bad part of it?
It really is. And let me give a little bit more, because this really is an excellent opinion. It kind of cuts through some of the nonsense claims that you may see finding success in other areas. And let me give you two of those, because these arguments come up again and again. The first is, Hobby Lobby argued here that they qualified for an exemption in paragraph 5, in section 5 of the Illinois Act, that permits men's and women's bathrooms in the first place, right? So I want you to think about, like, sort of the deviousness of that argument. In a great many cases where lawyers are asked to defend open bigotry against trans people, the source for that bigotry is, well, come on, we just, like, in the law, you have to make decisions sometimes, and you can draw a line, and I'm real sorry if drawing the lines makes some people sad, but, you know, that's what you have to do. It's no different than saying you can't drink till you're 21, you can't vote till you're 18, driving 66 miles an hour gets you a ticket, driving 65 doesn't, right? That's the best kind of steel botting I can do of that argument. And it says, look, and we have to do that because we want to preserve, you know, the right to have separate men's and women's bathrooms. I want to tell you the way this decision unpacked that argument, looking at that section 5103, which says, nothing in this article shall apply to any facility. And I just think about how this is written. Any facility as to discrimination based on sex, which is distinctly private in nature, such as restrooms, shower rooms, bathhouses, health clubs, and other similar facilities for which the department in its rules and regulations may grant exemptions based on bona fide consideration of public policy. So that's a lot of legal words kind of crammed in there. But basically it says, yeah, we are grandfathering and you don't get to sue the fact that, you know, a business has a separate men's and women's room. And here's how the Illinois appellate court tackled that distinction and said, okay, fine, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether a woman can use the woman's bathroom, right?
Yeah.
It says, this does not excuse Hobby Lobby's conduct here. As we've noted, Somerville is a trans woman. She is classified as female by this state and in Hobby Lobby's own personnel records.
This is just stopping someone from using the bathroom.
Yeah. Nevertheless, Hobby Lobby denies her the ability to use the women's bathroom, thereby treating her differently than its other female employees and customers.
Yeah, yeah.
This differential treatment cannot be discrimination based on sex. Somerville is female, just like the women who are permitted to use the women's bathroom.
Oh.
The only reason she's barred from using the women's bathroom is that she's a transgender woman, unlike the other women, at least as far as Hobby Lobby knows. Thus, the commission correctly found that Hobby Lobby unlawfully discriminated against Somerville based on her gender identity, that is, because she's trans. Even as Article 5, the bathroom exemption does not excuse discrimination based on gender identity. It therefore cannot aid Hobby Lobby here. And I just thought that was incredibly clever and sort of cut right
to the
heart.
I'm worried, though. Doesn't that seem like it would cut both ways? Because in the past, we've talked about the Flam and Ripple concurrence and stuff like that, where it's like, we want to get this stuff counted in, you know, like we want to get trans rights counted into certain things. And this sounds like a technicality to get it not counted in a thing, even though this is a good result. Is this going to come back to haunt us later?
That's a fantastic question. And I think the distinction here is what this does is not rule out trans rights, but rather says that discrimination on the basis of being trans comes from, under the Illinois statute, gender identity rather than just from gender rather than just on the basis of sex. Since gender identity is equally protected under the law, but does not form the basis for these bathroom type exceptions, that, in my view, gives you all of the upside with none of the downside. I am sure the Alliance Defending Freedom will try and come up with some sort of evil way to use this against us, but that seems like a hard argument to overcome. They also do the obvious job, but it's a good job, in saying that installing the unisex bathroom is not good enough. And the commission below characterized this as separate but equal, which, you know, I'm pro commission, right? And the appellate court said, yeah, the existence of the unisex bathroom is irrelevant to the main issue in this case, which is whether Hobby Lobby violated Somerville's civil rights by denying her, but not other women, access to the women's bathroom. Providing a unisex bathroom available to all employees cannot cure that unequal treatment, because if every employee and customer except Somerville may use either the unisex bathroom or the bathroom corresponding to their sex, but not her, then Hobby Lobby is still discriminating unlawfully. And that is totally straightforward. Yep. So this is, I think, a really straightforward but fantastic example of where courts are saying, okay, well, we've got to do the heavy lifting ourselves because the federal courts are a disaster. And we will break down in another episode the bad news, the whole women's health versus Paxton. But I'll summarize it here. Senate Bill 8, passed in 2017, has been litigated consistently since then. That outlaws the dilation and extraction procedure, which, again, as I said, is the most common procedure in the second trimester, refers to it as dismemberment abortion. And the bill requires a doctor performing a D&E abortion to first cause fetal demise by injecting a chemical compound into the woman, and then delaying for at least a day. So you can say, oh, well, we've now proven that the fetus is dead, and now you can extract it. Because the idea is, if you try and extract it while it's still alive, you're dismembering it, and that is causing the fetus untold pain. Yeah, the undisputed medical evidence is no, it isn't. The fetus does not have a complex corpus callosum at that age. And there are a ton of procedure, right? Like, if you applied that test, for example, to, I don't know, performing circumcision on a newborn male, you know, then that would not pass the test, right? Like, in no way has there ever been a compelling state interest in minimizing pain to a fetus. And that now is what, and so that was challenged at the district court. The district court held a 5-day trial in November of 2017 and enjoined Senate Bill 8 from going into effect. That was appealed to the Fifth Circuit. And last October, we covered this as a brief one-line good news item. 2-1 panel of the Fifth Circuit upheld that trial court ruling, said, absolutely, we're going to enjoin this abortion provision from going into effect. The Fifth Circuit later, sua sponte, right, on its own motion, decided to vacate that judgment, rehear the case en banc with the full 17-member Fifth Circuit. 14 justices participated, 3 sat out due to conflicts. Reversed, right? The panel said that there was no medical consensus and, quote, little merit to the state of Texas's argument that the D&E procedure causes pain to a second trimester fetus, and noted that major medical organizations, including the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have all concluded that fetal pain is not even possible before at least 24 weeks. And this is, we're talking 18 weeks and earlier. So, you know, a month and a half,
nothing
before there's pain. Instead, the new en banc decision says that it gives 4 different grounds for the state having an interest in this policy. But, I mean, 3 of them are so pretextual as to, I'm not even going to repeat them here. The one that is the linchpin is the state argues that by requiring doctors to choose alternatives to a brutal abortion procedure. By the way, that kind of language is rife throughout this opinion, right? And, I mean, you know, it says, you know, we wouldn't let you chop up a puppy, so why could you do it? I mean, it's just crazy. That evinces the state's, quote, profound respect for the life within the woman, end of quote. Dismemberment D&Es, I told you this case used ridiculous language, are self-evidently gruesome. It has long been illegal to kill capital prisoners by dismemberment. It is also illegal to dismember living animals. The state urges that SB 8 would simply extend the same protection to fetuses. That's page 15 of the opinion. I'm not going to bother to debunk those self-evidently stupid arguments, other than to say that, you know, where it comes to an obviously blatantly unconstitutional effort to make it impossible for women to undergo the most common form of abortion procedure in the state of Texas in the second trimester. This is one of those where I would have said, I don't care how pro-life the Fifth Circuit is, there's not a you can't get to the legal answer they want to get to. Well, I guess you can if you're motivated hard enough, and apparently they are. So this is a terrible result for pregnant people, for women and for those who can become pregnant. And I don't want to end with the downer. I want to end by saying we know the federal courts are effed. We do not know what the status is of your state courts and continue right to be active. Take solace in the fact that we've gotten fantastic decisions from states that I never would have expected, and let's, you know, we may be moving towards, you know, that kind of more local democracy. I'd rather have a robust, even federal protection, but I will take a state by state over nothing. So
yeah.
So congratulations, state of Illinois.
All right. Well, true to your word. I mean, we got a little good news, we got a little bad news, but sort of a good news sandwich. I'll take it. Or I guess you would call it a bad news sandwich. Again, you call the sandwich what's in the middle of the thing. Anyway, that's okay. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Blinkist. Did you ever want to be a better version of yourself, a more confident or knowledgeable you? The fastest way to do it is to get learning. Learn a new topic or skill or revisit something you learned in the past. Maybe get up to speed with something everybody is talking about right now. This can broaden your horizons and boost your self-esteem and success too. That's where the Blinkist app comes in. Blinkist takes the top nonfiction titles, pulls out the key takeaways, and puts them into text and audio explainers called Blinks that give you the most important information in just 15 minutes. Use Blinks to learn about topics like philosophy, history, and science, or dive into psychology, health, nutrition, or personal growth. You've got thousands of titles and 27 categories of the world's best knowledge to choose from. And if you're more of a podcast person, they have you covered with Blinks for Podcasts called Shortcasts. Blinks has the wisdom of top nonfiction bestsellers and podcasts packed into powerful 15-minute reads or listens, all in one app and right in your pocket so you can learn anytime and anywhere. Here's what I love about Blinkist. No matter how many books you ideally think you have time for, whatever that number is, whatever you're thinking, the number of books that you have time to fully read, guess what? The number of books in the world is a lot more than that. No matter how much reading you're doing, Blinkist is a way to get a little more in there than you did. Or maybe even a lot more, depending on how much you use it. So I do plenty of reading these days, especially with all my podcasts. But there's always stuff that I'm like, well, I want to read this book, but I don't know that I'm ever going to get to it. I don't know that I have time. So something like Fire and Fury, which I've brought up before, was a Trump book that I was like, yeah, I've already read all the Trump books, you know, but like with the Blink, I can get just the highlights from it. And it's like I read it and I didn't have to spend all that time. And right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/opening to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/opening to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/opening.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats. And update on this, we are doing it the right way. We're taking our time. It looks like the polling is overwhelming that we are going to reduce this segment in some way. But I want to give enough time for everybody. We also need to choose a method. So next poll on Patreon. And by the way, I did the polling so that it's just for the people in the top tier. So if you haven't seen this poll on Patreon, that's why. But anyway, if you are in this top tier of shoutouts, make sure to go answer the questions on the Patreon poll if you can. Give us your opinion. We want to make sure we are listening to everybody. But anyway, it looks like this segment will be shortened, but we haven't decided how yet. So we're still doing it for now. We're going to thank all of our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, and we have just hit 200.
Woo!
200, see, Andrew. This is going to... It's good.
See, that's the thing. All we're trying to do is we're trying to balance out. We want you to share this show far and wide, but every other week when you're sharing it, you're sharing probably, you know, 15 minutes of content that...
every other episode, not just every week. Yeah.
Yeah, every week, every other episode. You got a 50-50 shot that... Somebody's going to be like, well, I like that show, you know, for the first 45 minutes. Yeah. And then, you know, there was something about two lesbians and I don't, you know.
But the contract, the new contract has not, it's not been amended yet. So
we care. We care very deeply about it. Okay. Thank you to British Paratrooper School Class of 1942. Atomic Penguin at Atomic Penguin 7 on Twitter. Still want Wilkie. Joseph Vigiano, Ghost Dog, Statehood for DC and Puerto Rico now. Yeah. Dr. Scooplittle. Now here's something we hope you'll really like. Two Californians who aren't fans of Newsom, but are voting to keep him. Yeah, keep doing that. Comedian Aaron Trahan, a.k.a. Game Jumper X. Handwoven, machine washable, natural fibers at kellywovit.com. Trains are the most fuel-efficient way to move cargo in the world. That thing in the attic? The Fat Jedi eating cake and drinking Emperor's Brewery beer in the Death Star canteen. Republicans promised me court packing if Biden got elected. Where's my pack court? Liberals own guns too. Support root cause mitigation, not ineffective gun control. That guy. The Coins family. Good credit, bad credit, no credit. Come on down to Throckmorton Fraud. Throckmorton Fraud. Throckmorton Fraud. Ateo? Decarcerate, working to end mass incarceration in Arkansas. That is decarcerateAR.org, DECARCERATEAR.ORG, and that is great work. January 20th, baby, social justice alchemy, up with unions. Me and my co-host personally endorse Crowd Health, spelled K-R-O-U-D-H-E-L-L-T-H, and recommend it to all our listeners. Andrew and Thomas can read your name in 15 minutes or less while supplies last. Tom Morgan, get Tom's son. Zach Bloom, Ray, Pizza School the Quirky says, get vaccinated, wear a mask, and give your dog more treats. Yeah, I'm behind all that. LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Legal Eagle is so handsome. California employment, work accident, or litigation questions, call or text attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. Again, that is attorney David Nitka, 310-776-5879. The Smiths, praise be unto Hamilton. EMS in my area starts at $9 an hour. Vote to make us essential, not just expendable. Yeah. That Manchin is vote 50 is our fault, not his, so let's get at it. I get a raise, you get a raise. Want to meet the crazy dog, horse, goat, chicken lady crew? Well, I'm paying you to say yes, so here goes. We'll start with the horses. Rest in peace, Brandon Bernard. We must abolish the death penalty. Budget Botanist is still on vacation, so no Fiverr plant help, but does have a plant law episode idea, seconding Raleigh Live Show. PSA, contact your financial advisor if the duration of your Patreon list reading lasts longer than 4 hours. Sparkle Donkey Tequila, botanist of the week, is Budget Botanist, a rare fiber-based biologist that produces neat plant facts. I love that. See, this is the thing with keeping.
I know. We're not getting rid of all of it. One way or the other, we are not getting rid of everything.
Perpetually Exhausted East Coast Mary. New book, The Greatest Gift of All, A Logical Path from Religion to Humanism by Mark McLean, out now. Objection, USCF Rule 13C1 states that a director must never initiate a time forfeit claim for NF3. Well, I'll let you rule on that one, Thomas. Sorry for making you all try to say my friend's cat's name. I was proving to her that I'm a patron. 2WW Enchantment. If this is in your opening hand, you may begin the game with this on your battlefield.
Leyline of Sanctity. I already got it.
Ed, you didn't even need to know. You had hexproof.
Because I know it's white. There's a leyline cycle, so each color. Leyline of Sanctity, so it starts in your hand. You pop it on the thingy, and no one can target you. Super cool. Annoying, actually. I hate the card, but it's, it's a good sideboard card.
Did you know Transformers Kingdom just started up this week? Anyway, I hate PETA Malark. Oh, yeah, sure. Why not? Just get the clown horning vaccine, you clown horning clown horns. Anna Borishoff, I like my pork streaks paired with at Casa Agria and at Emperor's Brewery beer. 75% of Tulare County DAs have less than 2 years experience and they're doing felonies. Some are only provisionally licensed. If we don't get a Houston live show, I'll do nothing because I'm one patron. Lee Sharp, GDT says, Gnosia is a pretty enjoyable single-player sci-fi social deduction game. Interesting. I'll take a look. Ooh. And I overpronounced the G so that people could hear that on the radio. So, Thomas Kleberg, Benghazi in the Buttery Mails, Brian K., Buddy Freakin' Guyerson, followed Morgan on Twitter, now seeing different side of platform. Supreme Court justices should have 18-year term limits and so should Conrad Michaels. He'd disagree on that one. No coin at this firm has ever failed the bar exam. Two fabulous lesbians met a family that moved from a red state to protect their trans kid. Our own country is our newest source of LGBTQ refugees. Yeah. Edgy Veggie, Les Deux, Lesbiennes, Fabuleux. Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours, can't wait for Europe to be open again. Jennifer Chakowski, D&D minus cameo, question mark. We have legal advice. If ye have coin, do not take legal advice from a coin. Mutually supported communities are harder to oppress. Join or create a local mutual aid group. Mike Hall, E.V. Huntington, Harvard alum, no hood. 3, NC3, QD8, sorry I'm late. Yes, this is a real defense, I promise. I enjoy mocking people who mispronounce adopted French words that mean a peculiar ability. I guess I am a fort teaser. Torsten Peel and a goat asks, wouldst thou like to live deliciously? Like Thomas Smith, president of the American Honky Tonk Bar Association, support your local Peruvian restaurant. Angry Macface, there's a goat. Why is there a goat? Penelope is glad Sydney got sanctioned for terpsichore. Well,
there you go.
Hopefully you enjoyed last week's episode. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. This is not the greatest patron name in the world. No, this is just a tribute. Support AfricaPartnersMedical.org, providing volunteer U.S. MDs, RNs to bring the latest science-based practice to African MDs and RNs. April Poff, don't call me a mofo. I will have you know I'm an ex-mofo. I was a mofo for show, but I am a mofo no mo. Murray Gregerson, please give me the strength not to strangle the stupid MFing clown horn sucker. Minneapolis live show, come for the subpar baseball, stay for the subpar football, hockey, and men's basketball. Well, 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 if it isn't the consequences of my own actions. Actually, we can stop reading patron names anytime we want. It's not a contract, and consideration is ongoing. Proud sponsor of Defense Against Any Crowd Health Lawsuit. Thank you. Society for the Protection of the Third Amendment, celebrating a perfect record since 1792. Put your boss on a performance improvement plan. Pass the PRO Act. Since they have the Kraken lawsuits, can we have the Godzilla sanctions? Kaiju court battle. Jake, Seattle Pete, Crimer, no criming, and Guardian Ad Litem, Godot, and the Justice League. Thomas, you have 100 names, my friend.
No,
take it away.
No kidding. Thank you, too. Christopher Brown, Sam Cedar. Is that the Sam Cedar?
I sure hope so.
I don't think we've ever talked about that, but I think it could be. I don't. Stranger things have happened on our show. But anyway, if it is, hi, Sam. Thank you so much. That's awesome. Well, I mean, it is the Sam Cedar. Thanks, Philly Live Show 2022. I bring the cheesesteaks and fully stocked basement bar platinum night. Yep. Lawful Copter says, Andrew and Thomas, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for everything you do. MR, OA live show in Sydney, Australia, please. I won't be vaccinated till October at the earliest. Thank you, government. That's somehow coming up. We've been reading that one for a long time, and yet October is not that far away, really. The coin is rigging T3BE with a Chinese thermostat controlled by an Italian satellite. That's, yeah, my new lawsuit. Odin's bar exam pro tip. Do not flip a coin unless it's an approved accommodation. Go to milesformigrants.org to donate your Sky Miles and credit card rewards to help refugees get out of danger. Wow, that's interesting. Milesformigrants.org. Miles number 4 and then migrants.org. I'm going to check that out. That's very interesting. I don't know how that would work exactly, but I would totally do it. Robert M. Lou. Hold up in Japan, hiding from Delta, get my vax next month. If I die, mix my ashes with glitter and mail them to the IOC. Brevity, Nikoma Koska, famed soldier of fortune at your service. Now that Andrew has mentioned scrums and rugby, OA is my favorite rugby analysis podcast. Black Canyon of the Gunnison Live Show. Polly Hernandez, these are just simple farmers, people of the land, the common clay of the New West, you know, morons. Emily Rainbow Spence, in times when freedom seems lost, Great souls arise to reclaim it. Legendary human barbarian answer at thedeckboxhalifax.com. Another Minneapolitan waiting for our live show in Minneapolis. Jason Copas. Oh no, I am a third connection on Annie Schoeniver. Metacon 7 has a pot for pins and a pot for beans. Ian Hamilton. Hey Arizona, support Aaron Lieberman for governor. Spent my charity budget for the year. Help. Need everyone to roast the coin on Vulgarity for Charity. Stop calling him Uncle Frank. Nate Drex has to call him Dad. Annie Schoeniver, because we all hate health insurance, I decided to make something worse. Definitely not an MSNBC spy. My fully stocked basement bar is your fully stocked basement bar for a Philly Live Show Platinum event. You pick what's on tap. Listening for years, we just got the Buttery Mail's patron name gag. Wow, that's, oof, it took you a while. Jennifer Kratch, butts, three different ones. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. My stepdaughter is a fabulous lesbian, and all I got was this Patreon name. John Bilderbeck, my friend's cousin mixed Coke with Cop Rocks and he died. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, the reading of Hall of Fame patron names will continue until the filibuster is abolished. GiveToMozNeeds.org, GiveToMozNeeds.org. Philip Kaiser, Andrew the Arbitrary and Capricious, not that Chris Wallace. COVID showed me I am the kind of guy who wants a little prick. Why would anyone jump on a grenade when you could just put a pin in it? Absion, sorry for making you guys use the last one for so long. It was dumb anyway. Payne's Trumpet, Dude, Jonathan, Lord Kimbote. No, Your Honor, I am not a cat, nor am I a potted plant, but I am a karaoke legend, if that helps. Edit Wikipedia. Yes, you too can contribute to the world's foremost source of free knowledge and maybe get sued by a quack. Milo Meadsong wishes all Stephen Breyers a happy retire now. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Alfred Wallace. Peter Piper bequeathed pickle peppers producing pickle pepper perpetuities. The swordfish has no natural enemies, except for the even mightier penfish. Andrew is always fantastic because Thomas's theme music holds the rights to fabulous. False. Anonymous. WordOrigins.org, your source for word and phrase origins. My witty names aren't original, and my original names aren't witty. A series of bar suspensions, each more suspendy than the last. R.I.P. Notorious RBG. Nerd Gnostic sells art on Society 6. They said I could be anything, so I became two fabulous lesbians. Derek. Former undisclosed Red State senior executive branch official, now figuring out next gig. Big easy blasphemy. It's kind of nice having a competent federal government again. SummitsShuffleboard.com. Please be kind to your veterinarian. We are overwhelmed and doing the best we can. A string of unpronounceable characters. RondaTheDork.com. Malaika Chandler. They said I could be anything, so I became two princes who adore you. Soggy Pants, support bikeable cities to save America from the scourge of Eli Bostick in a car. Hey, Mr. Taliban, tally me bazooka, NATO gone and I want to go home. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. De jure belli et pacis at last, baby. Heather L., Matthew Vernon, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, either Ian and Ali, Danny Rosari, Adam Costa, Eli Bostick will have to reduce patronage amount for a while, but know that we love and appreciate everything you do. Aw, well, we're happy to have you for as long as we had you. That's no problem. We love you back. Happy 5-year OA anniversary.
Woo!
Wait, when was that? Did that just happen? Jeez.
That will happen by the time you read this, yeah.
Wow, really? Yeah. Happy 5-year, Andrew.
Yeah.
Happy 5-year, everybody. Well, that's a good amount of time for this patron Hall of Fame policy. You know?
And also happy impending nuptials to Heather L. So.
Whoa,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. She's,
yeah.
Congrats. So. That wasn't in the shout outs, but okay. And David in Brooklyn, Sam Danow, Mitchell, I'm sympathetic to this patron name. Does anyone else smell Indian food? Oh, hi, Noah. I agree with that 100%. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute, Sam Buck, and Conrad Michaels.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE answer time. Boy, a very tough question for a non-lawyer. Oh, was I even close? Let's find out.
So this was a question about repeated efforts at litigation. So, motorcyclist involved in a collision with a truck decides to sue the truck driver in state court. And again, the state federal court here is all red herrings for damage to his motorcycle.
Well,
jury.
Is it? I mean, there's the question of whether or not you could sue in federal court for something that's already decided in state court.
It, with the exception of a thing I'm about to point out. So, fair enough.
Not irrelevant.
It is relevant that the two courts are different. It is not relevant as to which one is state and which one is federal. Mm. So,
okay.
The jury returned a verdict for the truck driver. Court entered judgment. Motorcyclist then goes to sue the company that employed the driver and owned the truck in federal court for his injuries. And the company moved to dismiss based on the earlier state court judgment. And then the question is, if the court grants the company's motion, what is the likely explanation? And you and the coin went with issue preclusion, collateral estoppel, as establishing the company's lack of negligence. You were not at all tempted by C, which is violated the doctrine of election of remedies. That's good because election of remedies hasn't been a thing for over a century.
Okay.
So good job on that.
Yeah, at least I have an instinct for like, nah, apparently I have that instinct at least.
Election of remedies was a 13th century Saxony common law thing that said you had to choose in your complaint which remedy you wanted, and you couldn't change that thesis between filing the complaint and going to trial. In other words, you can't plead in the alternative. You couldn't seek inconsistent alternative remedies. And as you and I have discussed, the rule today everywhere, but particularly in federal court, is you can plead inconsistent remedies. And the classic example of that is breach of contract, right? You say, suppose you and I have a contract, but it's an oral contract, and you breach it. Use our same $500 to paint my house. You come by, you paint my house. I don't give you the $500. You would sue me for a couple of things. First, you would sue me for breach of contract, and you would say, yeah, we had a contract. Mm-hmm. You agreed to it. I came by, painted your house. Now give me the $500. But you would also sue me in the alternative for unjust enrichment. And you would say, you know what? Even if for some reason this crazy cockamamie court, who knows what courts are going to do, decides there isn't a contract, I have still conveyed a benefit to you. Namely, I've painted your fence,
right,
and you owe me compensation for the fair market value of that. And by the way, I can prove through our emails, the same emails that I'm going to use to prove the existence of a contract, will show that you value having your house painted at $500. And that simple kind of method of pleading in the alternative, you know, because you never know.
Right?
Yeah. And the existence of an oral contract is a really good example where, you know, you might have a he said, she said, you might have, you know, very little documentation. And lots of business deals get done that way, get done, you know, by the proverbial handshake. They shouldn't. It's part of what my practice does. But they do. So you plead in the alternative, nothing wrong with that. Election of remedies required you to choose, and it's an archaic doctrine. It's gone now and good. So you weren't befuddled at all by C. You also used in the alternative D, the state court judgment is law of the case. This is where the fact that it's two different cases makes it. Law of the case means that when you litigate an issue, you can't relitigate that issue in that same court in that same case, right? And so the fact
that's why I was very close between A and B rather than B and D.
Yep.
I went back and forth.
You were, and you should have been. You and the coin both went with issue preclusion. This is an area that trips up a lot of lawyers, not just on taking the bar, but as somebody who has litigated collateral estoppel versus res judicata on multiple occasions, contributed to one of the foremost decisions in Maryland on this issue, I can tell you courts get this wrong all the time.
Wow. Right? Even courts get this wrong.
They will say...
the bar exam.
They will say, well, this is res judicata as to the party. And what they really mean is that the party is collaterally estopped. Here's the difference, okay? Res judicata, claim preclusion prevents you from splitting your claims. That is, trying to take several bites at the apple until you hopefully get it right and then piling on with respect to that one. So claim preclusion applies to anything that arises out of the same transaction, the same common nucleus of operative facts, and basically says, if you could bring it, you have to bring it. There's a mandatory joinder requirement. Okay?
Okay.
Issue preclusion says that as against the same parties, when a prior court has actually litigated the same issue and decided it on the merits, that you are precluded from relitigating that issue in a subsequent case. So you can see how these overlap a lot. The easiest way to kind of remember and keep them straight is that the issue being litigated has to be identical and it must have been raised in the prior case in order to stop, to prevent you from doing it again. Res judicata means, yeah, we already decided that in a more sort of generalized way. And again, there are various criteria for whether something counts. It also has to be a court of competent jurisdiction. It also has to be a final decision on the merits. But res judicata is meant to stop you from taking multiple bites at the same apple. And when you read this hypothetical, that's what the motorcyclist is trying to do, right? He's trying to relitigate, hey, who's responsible for this accident? And the court is going to say, no. If you thought you had personal injury claims as a result of the accident, even if they were against a different party, that you should have brought all of these in the same lawsuit from the beginning, because I thought you came actually really, really close, not just when you came close to picking A, but in evaluating it, because you were like, well, the court's already decided that the driver wasn't negligent, right? But the court decided the driver's lack of negligence in connection with damage to the vehicle, right? Well, think of all the, and not with respect to injuries to the person, right? And think of all the different ways.
Let me put it a different way. I think this is what threw me off. I was imagining, what if the original thing had been successful? And then the person is like, the motorcyclist is like, oh, you know what? Not only did this truck driver injure me, the company that like hires him is responsible. Let's say it's Amazon and they've got the delivery trucks going too fast and all that. Does that not change the answer?
Same result.
So you have to raise that in the original claim.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah.
You think about it like the reason why claim splitting is kind of rolling the dice is that the way lawyers will try and do it is they'll bring part of the claim and then like kind of see how the case is going. And then you get a free, in federal court, you get a free amendment as of right. In different states have different rules about, their cases. And you would want that, right? Like, so for example, standard auto accident, Thomas sues Andrew. You don't discover until discovery that Andrew was working, I was on the job at the time and I was working for somebody else, but they just had me use my own car, right? Okay. So you might want to bring in my employer as a co-defendant at that time. And we would want you to be able to amend your complaint in good faith.
Oh, so you can still amend it that late?
Yeah, you can absolutely still amend.
After discovery?
During
discovery. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So,
that threw me off a little. Okay. So you would need to, I was close. I wish I had gone with A and B for the sake of my second chance. It's rare that my second chance loses, but it did. I got to say, this is one of those cases. Dang it.
Tough question, parsed well, and, at least the coin went down with you.
We'll have to see if the judges say we can count this usually I don't count the coin's loss unless it had the other choice, but it chose heads, so either way it would have lost. So I don't know. Well, it's an interesting philosophical question for Dan Dennett or somebody. But anyway, let's find out who the big winner is, who beat me and the coin and got the right answer. Who won? And it's my turn to do the T3BE winner. I am instructed to tell you that at @PopeInternet_I, which I guess is the first. But anyway, that person on Twitter said, answer is A, res judicata applies to claims that have been brought and claims that should have been brought. It's so hard to listen to Thomas talk himself out of the right answer. the Thomas Smith story, the T3B story. Yeah, I bet it was so hard. Andrew said not many people got this right, so that makes me feel a little bit better. That was a tough question. I got it wrong, but thanks to the Pope of the Internet, at PopeInternet_I, well done. You got it right. I don't know if the Pope needs any more fame and fortune. I think he could give some of that fame and fortune to the kids, you know, to the starving children in the world. But either way, here's a little more fame and fortune for you. Fame and fortune, definitely guaranteed. Because it's me, it's not Andrew. Congratulations, Pope Internet the First. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Ace Associate Morgan Stringer for the Brittany update. That was great stuff. And we'll see you for a rapid response Friday.
Until then,
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.